Hey, Paul, I'm excited to tell you that we are launching a Curbsiders Patreon. Have you heard about this?
I did because I work with you, but tell me more about it.
All right, Paul. Well, we want to be able to keep offering this great free content, and we're doing things like upgrading our website. We offer transcripts now for episodes, recording new seasons of our miniseries, Teach and Addiction Medicine. The Digest is growing its staff. And Paul, now we're on video. People can see us as we're talking right here.
What a treat for our listeners.
That's right. So with Cashlack admitting privileges, they're going to get all episodes ad-free. That's the whole back catalog, plus future episodes. And twice monthly, there's going to be bonus episodes where me and you recap a show and answer some listener questions. So people should sign up today at patreon.com/curbsiders, and you get a whole lot of more of Paul, America's PCP.
The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only. The topics discussed should not be used to diagnose, treat, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cashlack Memorial Hospital. In short, we aren't responsible if you screw up. Please do your homework and let us know if we got something wrong.
Dina, it's been too long. It's so great to see you again.
So nice to see you, Caroline. How have you been doing?
Great. I am fascinated by the fact that you have a harp in your background right now for individuals who may not be looking at the video.
Yes, I am in someone else's home and it is not my harp, so I cannot take credit for it, but it is quite exciting.
Have you been tempted to play it, though? It looks very enticing.
It's been very tempting, and also I thought it might disturb our recording, so I've refrained.
Probably for the best. Welcome back to the Curbsiders Addiction Med, our mini-series on substance use disorders. I'm Dr. Carolyn Chan, and today I have a great co-host, Dr. Zena Huxley-Riker. And today we just have a great episode that's chock full of pearls. I learned so much where we talk about long-acting injectable buprenorphine for the treatment of opioid use disorder with Dr. Ken Lee. But before we get too much into our content for today, Zena, will you tell the audience, what do we do on the show?
Of course, Carolyn. We are the Addiction Medicine Podcast, and we use expert interviews to demystify common addiction medicine topics, reduce stigma, and inspire listeners to be fierce advocates for all individuals who use substances. A reminder that most episodes are available for free CME credit through VCU Health. For all health professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org, all you have to do is create an account. And by listening to this episode and completing CME, you can use this to count towards the new DEA 8-hour requirement on substance use disorders education.
Special thanks to the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine, also known as ACAM, who have partnered with us to help support the Curbsiders Addiction Med miniseries. ACAM is the proud home for academic addiction med faculty and trainees, and they're dedicated to training and supporting the next generation of academic addiction med leaders. Visit their website at acam.org to learn more about their organization.
Tonight, we have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Ken Lee. Dr. Lee is the medical director at the London Rapid Access Addiction Medicine Clinic, or the RAM Clinic. The RAM Clinic was started in 2014 as part of the Arctic Meta PHI project. This project has developed a care path for patients with addictions to redirect from the ER to a RAM clinic. Dr. Lee's general medical practice is located within the Canadian Mental Health Association, providing medical and psychiatric care to persons diagnosed with serious mental illness. He teaches us how to initiate long-acting injectable buprenorphine and some practical tips to troubleshoot common problems that our patients experience.
Dr. Ken Lee reported the relevant financial relationships, speaker fees for Indivior and Knight. VCU Health Continuing Education has procedures to resolve any apparent conflicts of interest. So without further ado, let's get to it. Hey, Ken, thank you so much for coming on our show today. We just want to start off with some rapid fire questions to get to know you a little bit better. Do you mind giving us a one-liner to describe yourself?
Hi, I'm a doctor in Canada. Have been a doctor for a long time, longer than you guys have been around and alive.
Awesome. Can you tell us what your favorite aspects of working in the field of addiction medicine are?
What's really gratifying now is that there's some major advances in treatment of opioid use disorder. And we have actually been able to impact some change, especially with the explosion of fentanyl that's happening in Canada and the U.S. now. And so we do have strategies where we're going to provide some overdose protection against fentanyl.
Totally agree. I think the number needed to treat to use some of these medications that we're going to talk about today are much lower, honestly, than the traditional high blood pressure or statin medications that I use within my primary care practice.
Yeah, for sure. We're quite excited about what we've learned about buprenorphine LAI.
Great. Zina, why don't you jump in and read our first case?
Okay, for sure. So we have Ms. F, who is a 31-year-old female who's newly presenting to your office for the management of her opioid use disorder. She was referred after a hospitalization for a non-fatal overdose. And in talking to her about her history, you learn that she's been using opioids consistently for more than 5 years. She's mostly using intravenously and has been injecting fentanyl about 15 times a day. She's interested in trying to cut back on this use, but has had really negative experiences in the past with methadone and buprenorphine.
Great. And we are lucky here in the U.S. to have both LAI, buprenorphine, and injectable naltrexone, so intramuscular naltrexone. But for tonight's episode, we're really excited to really focus on LAI, buprenorphine. And in your experience, when would you start to consider LAI, buprenorphine over some of the other formulations?
With our patient population, we found that our retention rates were, I think our one-year retention rates were something like 40%, 40, 50% with buprenorphine sublingual. Methadone was about 50 or 60%. And then we, with the introduction of the buprenorphine LAI, we had our retention rate go up to about 60%, a one-year retention rate. So it works for a lot of patients because a medication really only works if it's actually taken. And so we learn from psychiatry where LAIs work better in many other areas of medicine. So the delivery system, I think, makes a difference.
Are there like other specific indications that you think of for the use of long-acting injectables for LAIs?
Well, what we'll learn now is that with oral sublingual buprenorphine, you can achieve a buprenorphine plasma concentration of about maybe 2.5 nanograms per ml, between 2 and 3 nanograms per ml, depending on dose. You really peak out with your buprenorphine dose at about 32 milligrams, and doses beyond 32 milligrams, you can't really get more a higher plasma concentration. Whereas with buprenorphine LAI, depending on the maintenance dose you're using, whether you're using the 100 maintenance dose or the 300 maintenance dose, you can get a buprenorphine plasma concentration of 3.2 with the 100 maintenance and 6.5 with the 300 milligram dosing. So significantly higher doses. And what's interesting about that is there was a study that came out in January 2022 from Leiden University, where they took actually healthy volunteers, opiate-naive and opiate-tolerant patients, and they established different levels of buprenorphine plasma concentrations and then intentionally gave them IV fentanyl to try to induce apnea. And they found that at a buprenorphine plasma concentration of 5 nanograms per ml, that the effect of IV fentanyl was essentially blocked by the higher buprenorphine plasma concentration. So that's some evidence, that's some new evidence that really was, it kind of matched what we were seeing in clinic.
Are there any specific like contraindications to the use of long-acting injectables, LAIs?
There's a couple contraindications, relative contraindications. If a woman is pregnant, you're not supposed to start them on an LAI because there's no studies to prove safety in pregnancy. But at the same time, if a patient who was on buprenorphine LAI, I hesitate to destabilize them by taking them off the LAI. So when you weigh the risks and benefits, it's probably better to leave the pregnant woman on an LAI. And there's been a number of case reports of LAI buprenorphine exposure in the OB literature and has not shown adverse effects. But again, that doesn't prove it, but it's very, very suggestive. So I think it's riskier to destabilize the patient and risk a relapse.
So it sounds like you really have a patient-centered conversation about what's known, what's unknown, risks, benefits, and sort of go from there. And I think hopefully too, I know there's a trial out, so hopefully we'll have some more data soon on the use of this in pregnant women. I know if you read the package insert, you'll see all these terrifying, scary things. You'll read and hear about individuals who may have significant like liver impairments or maybe are in hemodialysis. Do you view these as contraindications to using LAI-BUP?
Well, probably about 30-40% of our patients have hepatitis C, in various stages of hepatitis C. Some very advanced and some very early on. So if they have basically sufficient liver function to metabolize buprenorphine sublingual, I think they're okay to use buprenorphine LAI. In terms of hemodialysis, we have one patient who's on hemodialysis, unable to leave any urine samples for UDS testing, but we keep them on the lower dose, the 100 milligram maintenance dose of buprenorphine LAI. So that's about the only evidence that I have or experience that I have. So we're not too concerned about that.
Do you have like a spiel that you kind of use to talk about LAIs with patients? Like how do you explain this medication and how kind of present this as an option to patients when you're meeting them?
But patients found that it's very, very much more convenient not to have to go to the pharmacy to take their doses of methadone or buprenorphine. So that's one of the big sellers, and patients sell themselves on that. The other thing we learned about using LAIs is that with the 100 milligram maintenance dose, there is an incomplete euphoric blockade to the effect of smoking fentanyl, whereas with the higher dose, 300 milligram dose, there is euphoric blockade and to smoking fentanyl. What's interesting about that is when we were first started using buprenorphine LAI, as we had a number of dropouts of fentanyl patients and who came back later on. And further inquiry, we did not realize the euphoric blockade was so complete with the higher dose, the higher maintenance dose. Well, neither did the patient. Well, these patients may not have been prepared to give up their highs, and they dropped out after one or two shots. Came back later on. So now we have to educate patients that, hey, you know, if you're going to go on an LAI, the blockade is pretty good, pretty complete. So you may not be able to get a high when you smoke fentanyl or inject heroin. So we go in with that teaching. So if a patient still is not prepared to give up their highs, maybe they should stay on oral buprenorphine. And they know that you can stop it for 2 days and then you can use and experience your high. As long as you restart your buprenorphine within 4 or 5 days, there's no precipitated withdrawal. Or if they're a patient that really wants to just maintain and not have a daily withdrawal, maybe they're better suited to methadone. And so our education is a little bit more specific into molecule and delivery system now. So we have less dropouts because we tell them, you know what, this could be the end of your fentanyl high. And not everybody's ready for that.
I think that's a great point to take this patient-centered approach because patients will be more likely successful if their goals and your goals are aligned. So it sounds like there is a role for these medications, even if patients are not interested in complete abstinence, you know, but that you think about dose reduction, particularly with LAI buprenorphine. It sounds like you're probably not pushing the 300 milligram maintenance dose, maybe in folks who don't want to be fully abstinent.
Yeah, we push the 300 milligram dose in patients who are using fentanyl, who want to be abstinent.
And just, you know, I probably should have broken this down for the audience at the first place. There are generally two doses of the LAI buprenorphine. So there's the 300 milligrams and there's the 100 milligrams. So in a traditional standard approach, oftentimes individuals are receiving 300 milligrams the first month, 300 milligrams the second month, followed by 100 milligrams maintenance, was sort of what the traditional package insert sort of teaching was. But as you alluded to in the era of fentanyl, now we are sometimes just keeping patients indefinitely on the 300 milligrams per month dose.
Yeah, indeed. That's what we did at the beginning when we didn't have a lot of experience with buprenorphine LAI. Everyone got 300, 300, followed by 100 maintenance. And then we noticed that our fentanyl patients relapsed more, had more fentanyl use, could get high. And so the product monograph recommended going up to 300 if the 100 was insufficient. And indeed, the 100 was insufficient in fentanyl-using patients. And so learning that, after the first 20, 25 patients, we decided that we're not going to drop them to 100. We're going to keep them at 300. And so that's part of the learning curve in using an LAI.
Awesome. So you discussed the options for treatment, and Ms. F decides that the LAI buprenorphine sounds like the most feasible option for her. She has trouble taking medication daily, and she likes the idea of a monthly injection. So I guess just thinking about kind of this moment of starting LAI buprenorphine for someone, what are some of the different options to initiate someone from fentanyl or other opioids to this injection?
There's a number of different buprenorphine induction options, and there's the term of the standard induction, the microdose induction, the macrodose induction, and then hybrids and mix and matches through all those three techniques and protocols. And so traditionally, the way we used to use buprenorphine in the beginning years ago was a patient had to present in withdrawal, COWS, the clinical opiate withdrawal scale, had to be 13, and then you would give them 4 milligrams of buprenorphine, wait an hour or so, give them another 4 milligrams, send them home, they come back the next day, and they get 8 milligrams in clinic, and then another 4 milligrams later for 12 milligrams on day two. And then day three, you would do the same thing and get them up to 16 milligrams if needed. And back in the day, that 16 milligrams was sufficient before the days of fentanyl. Now, with the days of fentanyl, we have to use, most patients end up on 24 milligrams of buprenorphine. The microdose induction is something that was out of Bern, Switzerland, 2018, 2019, something like that. And the idea behind that was that tiny doses of buprenorphine sequentially added, given a time interval, could be as short as 4 hours, 8 hours, 24 hours, if that's what's practical. And you gradually build the buprenorphine dose up. Initially, we were building the dose up to 12 milligrams through once-a-day dosing. So it would take 12 days, right? You increase by a milligram a day, roughly. And then we were more aggressive. We were going twice a day inductions. And then some in-hospital patients are getting Q4 inductions, right? But practically in the outpatient clinical setting, you're doing once daily or twice daily inductions. So you gradually build it up. And once you get up to buprenorphine 12 milligrams, you can probably just abandon the other opiates that are being prescribed, whether it's a fentanyl patch or they're smoking fentanyl, injecting heroin. They'll find that they don't need to take any more of the other opiate, and then you can just build up your buprenorphine dose quickly at that point in time. So the greatest fear in buprenorphine inductions is something called precipitated withdrawal. And what happens is when you give a patient buprenorphine when there's lots of opiates in the system, you displace the full mu agonist with your partial agonist, and it puts the patient into a relative state of withdrawal. Very, very uncomfortable. In our day, patients did not like that in the standard inductions. Your biggest risk of precipitated withdrawal is with buprenorphine doses between 2 and 8 milligrams. And that's what I've termed the PW zone, the precipitated withdrawal zone. And so what you do is either you go slowly through the PW zone, so the withdrawal that you're causing is tolerable, or you go to macro inductions where you just zip right through the PW zone. And what we do now is give people buprenorphine 16 milligrams to overcome that PW zone, and that's what's called macro dosing. you have to be a little bit selective in the patients you choose and how to do this. We do require, and this is learned from all the PW that I caused, is that you need to be 72 hours out from methadone use, 48 hours from a long acting, which is a Contin or a Cadian, and 24 hours after smoking fentanyl or short acting use. And you can power through with the macro induction quite nicely with avoiding precipitated withdrawal.
So let's take us through an example in clinic. Say we have a patient, it's been 24 hours since they last smoked fentanyl, no other long-acting, you know, opioids in their system. And they're coming into your clinic and they're in withdrawal. You know, they have a CAS score of like 12, 13. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you give them 16 milligrams of bup right away in clinic. Mm-hmm. And then if they still aren't feeling well, would you give them more bup? And would you be able to consider even starting like an LAI that same day?
So we've modified our macro dosing inductions quite a bit. Initially, we were using bup 8 milligram tablets. And we caused our fair amount of our fair share of precipitated withdrawal because we were putting them right in the PW zone. Because with a tablet, your absorption is never complete, right? You give 8 milligrams and they're not getting 8 milligrams. They're getting between 4 and 8 milligrams. And if they don't hold it in their mouth long enough or swallow the saliva, that's all they're getting, right? So we overcome that by giving a large dose of buprenorphine now, 16 milligrams. And we use film because the absorption of film is much more reliable than with tablets. We've also learned to pre-medicate patients with ondansetron 8 milligrams and diazepam 10 milligrams to kind of ease that period of induction. And then after we get them to 16 milligrams of buprenorphine, if they're not quite comfortable, we'll top them up with another 8 milligrams film or tablet. And then if they're mostly comfortable by then, you know your PW risk is gone. You've overcome that. And then we can give the LAI in clinic at that time. So this is a patient who was presented to your clinic in opiate withdrawal with fentanyl. I always do a UDS on a patient, no matter what, right? Because you do want to know there's no methadone metabolite or other things in their system. The fentanyl in Canada is mostly contaminated with etisalam and bromazolam and xylazine. So we have to consider those other things as well. So that's when I started adding in the diazepam. At that time.
You're really lucky. It sounds like in Canada, it's fairly easy to get long-acting injectable buprenorphine same day. I will say in the U.S., in the outpatient clinic, unfortunately, we often have to send in specific paper to insurance companies. So I have not had the luxury of being able to give LAI bup the same day I do an induction, unless somebody, you know, is in the hospital. But that's great to know that folks can consider that in particular settings, as well as in my practice too. I do want to mention, I often do have most of my patients on 16 to 24 milligrams of bup, but there are some patients where I think they have lower tolerance, you know, for whatever reason. Maybe they're not using fentanyl, maybe they're just using, you know, full agonist opioids, where I like to make sure that they can tolerate at least 8 milligrams of buprenorphine before I give a 300 milligram dose, just because it is long acting. Do you do anything similar in your practice in terms of thinking about a minimum dose of bup someone should be able to tolerate before they get a long acting injectable?
Yeah, it's the same for me in Canada here. We do have a few patients who are only oxycodone tablets or prescription morphine, and they end up on lower doses of buprenorphine, somewhere between 8 and 12 milligrams. And you'll find that when we do want patients to be able to tolerate an 8 milligram dose, at least an 8 milligram dose, before we consider buprenorphine LAI. And what you find for the patients who are on the lower end of that dosing range, 8 milligrams, that first dose of buprenorphine LAI can cause a bit of sedation, which can last for a day or two. Your peak buprenorphine effect, plasma level after buprenorphine injection, is at the 24-hour mark, and it gradually goes down over the next 24 hours. So the first 2 days, you might get some sedation. Patients might get a little bit of nausea from the opiate effect, but otherwise it's generally well tolerated. So you do need to warn your lower dose patients that they might get a bit sedated with that very, very first injection. This doesn't really apply to fentanyl patients because they can tolerate just about anything. So it's the lower dose patients got to be careful.
And I will say, in my expert opinion and in my practice as well, if you read the package insert, right, they recommend keeping somebody on the same dose of buprenorphine for 7 days. Okay. And again, this is what the package insert reads, but in my clinical experience as well, and it sounds like yours as well, Ken, oftentimes you don't need to do that. You just have to make sure that they have the opioid
tolerance
for 8 milligrams. Yeah.
When we first started using buprenorphine LAI, we waited that 7 days. And then, you know, a patient would show up a day early and you go, well, you know, 6 is okay. And it gradually creeped down after you've done your first 25, 50 patients. And you realize it does not have to be a full week. But the reason it's the full week is that's what the registration study did. So that they get licensed based on the registration study. But in real clinical experience, it does not need to be a full 7 days. Oh, but that's very off-label.
Yeah. I think that this conversation is a great kind of segue into thinking about counseling your patients on some of the side effects and adverse effects that they might experience from this LAI buprenorphine. So what are the common things that you see and that you counsel people about before you start this medication?
The most common thing you hear about a patient is actually the pain of the injection. Various different injection techniques you can use, but what we've learned is to ice the area before the injection. We warm up the injection to at least room temperature, and that takes about 20 minutes or so. Or you can hold it in your hand, that helps heat it up a little quicker. If you give an injection, a colder injection, it's a little harder to give. And it's a little more painful. So if you ice the area first, warm up the injection, give the injection quickly. We give it quickly over 10 seconds. Even with the 300 milligram with the larger volume, the 1.5 cc volume, we can still get, as long as it's warm, you can get that injection in within 10 seconds, which means your needle is out of the abdomen before that burning reaction starts. It starts at about the 10-second mark. After injection, we put our ice pack on right away to help with that post-injection burning pain, which lasts for about 30 seconds. So you do have to warn patients about that, and you tell them, you know, this is just a short-term pain for a whole long month game where you don't have to go to the pharmacy every day. That's one. And number two is that the depot subcutaneous injection leaves a bit of a lump in the belly. It's about a centimeter, kind of like a jelly bean size in the abdomen. And the 300 milligram injection leaves a nodule for about 4 months. The 100 milligram nodule leaves a nodule that lasts for about 2 months. And so when you're giving your next injection, you notice that the previous nodule is still there. And so we just rotate around the abdomen in different locations and try not to inject into the same quadrant again. When you come back at the 5 month mark for injection number 5, that quadrant should be empty. There should be no palpable nodule at that time. If you give your injection a little bit farther from the umbilicus, still subcutaneous, it's a little less painful. If you give it too superficial, it's a little bit more painful. If you give it intracutaneously too superficial, you form a little bleb. Although I haven't done that, I have heard of cases where that's done, and there's been some skin breakdown at the injection site in a too superficial injection. So you wonder, how can anybody do that? Well, in your very skinny patients who have very little body fat, you may find it difficult to find a place to put that in the abdomen because there just is no body fat. I have not looked at alternative injection sites, but the company is looking at that in their studies.
Great. So our patient presents to you today, has successfully started sublingual buprenorphine. You did a high dose induction and is now ready to start their first dose of LAI buprenorphine. Do you mind just like walking us through this whole process? So you talked to us a little bit about prepping the patient for minimizing pain and discomfort, such as by using ice, making sure, you know, the medication is at room temperature. Can you tell us a little bit more about any other skin prep you do? How do you position the patients? Where are you injecting the angle of the needle, et cetera?
Yeah, generally we do the patients lying down, apply the ice. It's a 5/8 of an inch needle. We introduce it at 45 degrees. You can pinch up the skin a little bit to, you know, pick up some fat and inject it into that pinched up area. And then you basically do your injection quickly, let go before the injection is completed, because you want to not squeeze any of the solution out. So it is not uncommon to get a little drop of liquid when you do the injection. You try to avoid that by not pinching too hard or releasing the pinch when you do the injection. Most people will have enough adipose tissue that you can do it laying down. If it's a very skinny patient and you have a little trouble getting some subcutaneous fat, we all know that when you sit up and lean over, you get a little bit of a abdominal roll, and you find a little subcutaneous tissue and fat that way. So sometimes you got to do patients sitting up.
And just to review the location of the injection, so generally it's subcutaneous into the abdomen, and I think about it in terms of kind of like each of the four quadrants, right? Whereas we're sort of picking a location in all of those sites and rotating. And I always try and go like clockwise in my practice, so I have a sense of where I'm going to go next.
Australia, they probably go counterclockwise. The other tip that we learned is that you try not to do the injections so low that it's sitting on their belt line of their pants. So it depends if they wear their pants really high or really low. And the other thing is seatbelt location. So if you put it where they always wear their seatbelt, that's not really that nice if you have to take a long road trip. So a couple little things.
Yes. I think I'd be amiss not to say as well, don't forget to draw back to make sure you're not, for some reason, in a vein, because we definitely want to avoid injecting into a vein, artery, etc.
Absolutely. That goes without saying.
I had to say it. I couldn't help it.
Yeah. Good injection practices. So I know that the way that the package insert is written, it's supposed to be dosed every 4 weeks. But I guess kind of in your practice, what is kind of the dosing interval that we think about in terms of the ideal versus maybe some of the more practical real life situations that you encounter?
So practically, you want the injections every 4 weeks. The manufacturer's recommendation is between 26 and 42 days, so you have a bit of leeway on your dosing. But ideally, you would like it every 4 weeks. Funny thing, patients don't always come every 4 weeks, and so sometimes patients will come late. If they come within the 42-day interval, you just give them the injection. The interesting thing we found is amongst our fentanyl users that they were getting into some withdrawal symptoms at about the day 21 after that first dose, after that first 300 milligram loading dose. And initially, I was supplementing with oral buprenorphine for those 7 days. And, when I looked at some of the pharmacokinetic plasma level data, the plasma level drops with that first injection at about day 21 below 2 nanograms per ml. So we thought that we could just simply give the second dose at day 21. So we give it a little bit earlier. And that has basically extinguished the need for supplemental oral buprenorphine doses. Some of the new data, and this is very, very off-label, this is something we've been only doing for the past month or so, is I looked at some of the pharmacokinetic data, and there are some studies that they're giving the LAI the first two loading doses 1 week apart, similar to a dose stacking with some antipsychotic medications. And so we've been doing that for the past month or so with some of our very heavy fentanyl users. And it seems to make them a little bit more comfortable. But generally, it's every 4 weeks, maybe 3 weeks on the outside for your average case. And a very specialized case, we may give them more frequently. And then after that, we give them every 4 weeks as recommended. After you get roughly four doses of buprenorphine LAI in, you do reach close to steady state between 4 and 5 doses, let's say 4 doses. Interestingly, patients will naturally space themselves out after that time. So we ask them to come every 4 weeks, and then they come every 5 and every 6, sometimes 7. You don't usually get them beyond 7 or 8. which is very interesting, right? So they're kind of self-selecting their interval of injection, although we're telling them to come every 4.
I think that's a great point. I often see that in my clinical practice as well, is that folks, particularly in the first month, sometimes even after that, honestly, I think sometimes they'll still see it in month 2, month 3, where at the end of the month, they're describing, this just doesn't feel like it's holding me. I'm having more cravings. So it is pretty common in my practice, maybe for the first 1, 2, 3, 4 months to add, 2 or 4 milligrams sublingual to supplement, as well as just folks in the U.S. practicing, just be cautious about giving their dose too early, because again, insurance companies will frequently, not cover the medication, mm-hmm. and you don't want to, put a patient at risk if the dosing intervals all of a sudden have to be like even further spaced apart.
Yeah, in Canada, we're having some trouble. We've overcome this issue, but when you're giving supplemental oral buprenorphine doses, you're ordering buprenorphine LAI, then you're ordering tablets as well. So, the insurance companies say, well, why are you giving both? What's going on here, right? So we've overcome that. We've written a few letters and explained the situation, but that may come up in the U.S. as well.
What about patients who, as you said, space themselves out, or just their lives are in such a scenario where they can't come regularly? Like, what is the longest period of time you can go where you can still give, LAI safely without having to do a reinduction process?
So once a patient has had reached steady state of 4 injections of LAI, whatever their interval is, as long as they're kind of close to, the recommended 4 weeks. If they're, what we've learned is that if they're beyond 6 weeks, beyond the 42 days, what we were initially doing was giving a test dose of buprenorphine oral, 8 milligrams, to make sure there's no precipitated withdrawal, and then proceeding with the LAI. And so we were doing that if they were beyond 6 weeks. And then we learned that if they're between 6 and 12 weeks after reaching steady state, you don't really have to give that test dose of buprenorphine, 8 milligrams. So we just give the their dose up to 12 weeks. And this is, again, this is after you reach steady state. You're not doing this within the first 4 weeks, the first 4 doses. It's after steady state. If they're between 12 and 18 weeks out after their last LAI injection, we do try to take a careful history of ongoing use. If there's ongoing use, we will go with a test dose of buprenorphine 8 milligrams. If their UDS is negative for outside opiates and shows only buprenorphine, it is safe to give you buprenorphine injection without a test dose, because you're not going to cause a precipitated withdrawal. If it's beyond 18 weeks, we're doing a restart with oral and then going to the LAI. If that's what the patient so chooses, if they want to continue on LAI, go on oral buprenorphine or go to methadone. So there's a decision, why did you not come back?
And with that kind of 12 to 18 weeks, if there isn't any other outside opioid use, are you starting at the 300 milligram dose? Are you using the 100 milligram dose? Kind of where are you in that dosing cascade?
If they were on the 100 maintenance dosing, I would keep them at the 100. If they're at the 300 milligram maintenance dose, I would keep them on the 300. Okay. And the UDS is very important. So you got to see the UDS and compare the UDS to patient report. And as long as the UDS is negative and patient reports no use, your precipitated withdrawal risk is negligible. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind, your UDS is not always accurate, right? Because it's not picking up fentanyl analogs and some other synthetics that we don't know about. So that's why you need the history plus the UDS. Then you can confidently go ahead. If you're not sure in any way, then you're doing a test dose or you're doing a restart.
That makes sense. Thank you.
So just to summarize that, so basically, if it's been 6 weeks since your last dose of buprenorphine, LAI, which is pretty forgiving, it sounds like you're pretty much okay to give another dose because it should still be in your system. After that, It really depends on the clinical situation. Have they reached steady state? What's their history? What does their urine test show? And you kind of have to make a clinical decision using those factors. But you can't go wrong, it sounds like, by giving a test dose and then, you know, proceeding if there's no precipitated withdrawal. Does that sound accurate?
That sounds like very wise advice.
Great, especially if you're trying this for the first time. What other common issues do you see that patients experience on this medication? Other common things folks should know about how to troubleshoot?
Yeah, one of the things we've learned over the past year with itizolam and bromazolam that's in the urine is that if a patient has reached steady state with buprenorphine LAI and still describes withdrawal symptoms making them use fentanyl, if you ask them really, really carefully, those withdrawal symptoms tend to occur the next day after they've stopped using fentanyl. And we attributed that to a benzodiazepine withdrawal from itizolam or bromazolam. And so we've been managing that with our three-day diazepam protocol, where we give diazepam 10 milligrams once a day for 3 days. We do it as daily observed doses at the pharmacy. Because, as you know, what will happen is that if you order 3 10 milligrams of diazepam, it'll be all gone in day one. So we do like to control it a little bit. And that's about 50-50 effective in breaking the cycle of use. We'll do that a couple times, two or three times. But we don't do it on a continuous basis, because then you'll have a patient on diazepam, which has its own problems.
That's a great point, because as you said, the LAI bup is really going to peak within 24-ish hours. So if somebody is experiencing withdrawal, ask yourself, is there something else they could be withdrawing from? Because you would assume that their symptoms should be getting better in that time frame as the buprenorphine goes up. I think that's a great point.
UDS testing is very, very helpful. UDS testing augments the reliability of patient-reported use.
It's not so easy for us to test for things like etolazam, and also, it's much more challenging for us to test for benzodiazepines at this time here.
Yeah, to test for those, the synthetic fentanyl analogs and these other benzodiazepines, you do have to use the lab chromatography. Your point of care dip tests don't pick these things up. Like the point of care benzo test does not pick up bromazolam, but it will pick up itizolam. But it may not pick up some of those analogs.
Any other common kind of adverse reactions or issues that you've had using LAI buprenorphine?
We get a few rare reactions. One person complained of itchiness every time they got their injection. Hard to say if it's a true allergic reaction or more of a local reaction. We manage that with a dose of Benadryl. A couple days before the injection, it seems to keep things down. Some patients complain of a lot of pain when they inject, when they get the injection. I can't explain why some patients experience way more pain than other patients. We've had a couple patients, they're in the jail setting, where they tried digging out the depot gel to try to suck on it and get buprenorphine unsuccessfully. All they did was cause a wound infection. And we've had three or four out of the, thousands of injections we've given, we have had three or four injection site infections managed in the usual way. Nobody's required an IND except for the guy that tried digging out the LAI.
In my practice, too, I have used LAI buprenorphine to actually help someone taper off buprenorphine who's been stable, for a long period of time and has decided that they want to try coming off or has had challenges tapering at lower doses. And there are some case reports out there as well in this. Is that something you do or use in your practice ever?
Yeah, I actually write up some of those case reports. We've done it about 10 times now. So we have our patients on oral buprenorphine, and they're tapering down. We get down to buprenorphine 8 milligrams. And then at that time, we now know to suggest or offer a buprenorphine 100 milligrams one-and-done injection. Works about half of the time. Half of the patients will require another injection. anywhere between 4, 6, or 8 weeks later. And if a patient requires a third injection, they were not ready to taper. So that's our protocol. So yeah, we drop them to buprenorphine 8 milligrams and do a 100 milligram one and done injection. Works about 50-50.
This has been such a great conversation. I do want to take note of just one difference that probably exists between the U.S. and Canada. To actually prescribe LAI bup, it's really important to know that you're sending it to a pharmacy that's actually certified to do this. So not every pharmacy in the United States is going to have the ability to actually dispense this medication to your office. So it has to be a certified pharmacy through the REMS program. So a physician will order the LAI bup to a REMS certified pharmacy, and then that pharmacy will actually deliver it to the practice where we would administer it. So it's not a medication, you know, a patient goes to the pharmacy and just picks up, because we don't want folks injecting it, because that could actually cause some pretty serious harms to the individual. And in the clinic as well, the clinic must be able to store the medication in a lockbox in a fridge and be prepared to sort of follow these very specific guidelines in order to provide it. And the goal of this, or what they say, is truly prevent the unintentional administration of this medication into a vein, which, as I said, could result in a serious harm. It could possibly even be life-threatening for an individual. So folks who are interested in doing this in their practice, you know, definitely partner with a pharmacist so they can help walk you through this process and make sure all the regulations are in place.
Okay, Carolyn, that's a very important thing to mention. We have similar controls in Canada, but the control in Canada is on the prescriber. The prescriber has to be certified to prescribe buprenorphine LAI in Canada. The pharmacy, any pharmacy can fill it, but they have to have the capability of delivering it to your clinic within cold chain. And so buprenorphine LAI is stored, much like vaccines, with a cold chain. The pharmacy has to ensure that you have to have a refrigerator to store it. In Canada, we have to do narcotic counts, start counts and end counts at the end of the day to make sure nothing has disappeared. Fridge has to be locked and secured. We have to have two locks, one on the fridge and one on the door of the room going into the fridge. Once your buprenorphine LAI is out of the fridge, we do warm it up. It's not expired if it's not injected that day. You do have 7 days to do that injection.
They couldn't make it any easier, could they?
Just a few rules. Awesome. Well, this has been so wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us, Ken. Do you mind just sharing some take-home points for our listeners?
Take-home points. We have used buprenorphine LAI in about 500 patients now in our center in London, Ontario. This is a city of with a population of about 350,000-400,000. And in the past year, there has been a noticeable decrease in opiate overdose fatalities in our city. So we are gratified to contribute to that. We are now getting patients who come in specifically asking for the injection because they've heard it from fellow users and friends on the street. So it has made a substantial difference in our town. And I think it can be used in a similar way in many other cities in Canada and the U.S.
That's great. Do you have anything you want to plug tonight? It could be addiction related. It could be non-addiction related.
What I'd like to plug is that our clinic is a fairly well-resourced clinic. It's not just the doctors and nurse practitioners. We have a whole team that does the psychosocial counseling. So we have addiction counselors and social workers, and that certainly is equally as important in the recovery path as in just the physiology. So we, the doctors, look after the physiology, and our social workers and counselors help with the psychology.
Great. Well, I've learned so much today. This has been just such a great conversation. I hope all of our listeners enjoy it. So thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me, Carolyn and Zena.
This has been another episode of our Curbsiders mini-series, The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine. Get your show notes now at our new and improved website, thecurbsiders.com/addiction.
We are committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at curbsidersaddictionmed@gmail.com. A special thanks to Dr. Matt Watto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support in this project, as well as ACAM, the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine. Learn more about the organization at acam.org. Big shout out to our team for this episode, including our editor, Dr. Pyle Roy, and our whole team. The Curbsiders is produced and edited by the team at PodPaste.
A reminder that this and most of our episodes are available for free CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.bcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. And until next time, I've been Dr. Carolyn Chan.
And I'm Dr. Zena Huxley-Riker. Thank you for joining us today and letting us bring you some addiction medicine pros.